Hey everyone, this is John.
This is Wales.
This is also Wales.
No, it was Ryan.
This is the Nintendo Show 64, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. And like the name implies, we're going to talk about Nintendo 64 games. We do this sort of semi-chronologically as they came out 21 years ago. So we're peeking all the way back to November of 1999. And what a time to be alive that was.
Oh, yeah. You know, things were great, weren't they? You know, we were at the top of the hill, looking over the vista, looked beautiful instead of being
as we've mentioned in the weeds many times on these retro shows. It was the 90s. We had everything figured out. There were no more problems in the world. Everything was going to be great from there on out.
Absolutely. You know, just like streets paved with gold, clear skies all day, 72 degrees.
But women were making 72% of what men were making. It was great.
Oh, they knew their place. They knew their place.
So where is Wes? We haven't seen him.
I know. I think it's weird. He and Lindsey Graham are doing this thing.
God.
And they haven't made it exactly clear exactly what's going on between the two of them. But
He mentioned something like trying to steal something. There's some sort of heist they're trying to pull off.
I think he's actually trying to steal the Constitution. And wants to just like write in Donald Trump as emperor or something to that effect.
Yeah, maybe.
You know, and Rudy Giuliani's involved in the scheme somehow. I think maybe he's like a...
He wants to steal democracy, just the concept of democracy. Right. He wants to take it and let no one have it ever again. So, well, there's actually a bunch of worthwhile games and topics that I think would be fun to talk about that happened in 1999. We will, of course, focus mostly on Nintendo 64 games.
Okay.
Just as a side note, we typically also bring up non-Nintendo stuff, nothing too noteworthy in the world of PlayStation or Sega Dreamcast.
Out. Usually there's nothing of importance
ever
to talk about that's not Nintendo.
Yeah.
So
nothing else matters.
Rare that it does come up.
The Sega Dreamcast was also out outside of the launch. It came out in September. So, you know, the real heavy hitters that were like just in the like beginning of the year 2000 into mid-2000. Of course, we're not there yet, and we're not a Sega podcast, so, you know, we probably won't spend too much time on
that. Is there a Sega podcast?
There's probably some Sega podcasts out there.
Oh, wow.
I'll see if I can find some good ones. We'll recommend them. Okay. Give them the Nintendo Show bump.
Yeah.
Of course, like, the most noteworthy Sega Dreamcast game that we're ever going to talk about is Code Veronica.
A wonderful game, yes.
Which, you know, bears some connection to what we're talking about here, because Resident Evil 2 was ported to the N64. Actually, the release date that I'm finding for through most sources is October 31st, 1999. So, you know, we're a few weeks
later. If you timed your day right, you had a great Halloween.
Yeah. Yeah, what a day that would have been.
Yeah.
So we both played Resident Evil 2, yes?
Oh, like, I don't know if I mentioned this on the last time, but the first internet forum I was ever on was dedicated to Resident Evil.
Nice.
Like, I loved that game so much back in the day. I think it hit me in this weird time in my life where I was like, zombies are cool. I think everybody has that thing where everyone's like, zombies are cool. And, you know, this gen, like, the newer stuff is, like, everyone's into, like, things like Walking Dead. And I guess that Zombieland movie was probably the last big, really big zombie property.
Yeah, you know, it's zombies, but it is zombies that are not just, like, the sort of moaning with their arms stretched forward kind of thing. Like, they've come to take different forms, so, you know. Or, like, invariably, if you have a zombie franchise that goes for a while, you know, there are zombies that, you know, become more intelligent or more agile.
And those have been kind of normalized in a weird way, if you think about it. Like, zombies used to be really, really terrifying. Used to be really, really scary things. But now it's like Shaun of the Dead. Plants vs. Zombies is a game that we give to kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like, kids are now, like, aware of zombies, and it's not, like, sort of this, you know, weird thing meant for, like, you know, George Romero films or things like that, or like really gory midnight movies that you would see on TV and things like that. So
yeah, because there was a time, and you know, I think Resident Evil is reflexive of this as well, where you know, there you were trapped somewhere and you couldn't leave because of the hordes that would come after you, and like you're stuck somewhere and you have to make sure that the place you are remains safe.
Yeah.
So you know, there's sort of a claustrophobia to things that involve zombies, whereas now zombies they're just fodder for them. You know,
they're not, and there's Nazis, but there's also like what Dead Snow is, a Nazi zombies.
Mm.
You know, it's literally they've just become kind of a prop.
Yeah,
you know, and a bit of a cliche.
Well, you know, there is something just inherently satisfying about like mowing down a horde of zombies, because you know it's guilt free. You know, it's violence and it's gore, but you're not thinking like, oh my god, look at all this like this mass murder that's taking place. They're already dead.
Yeah, they're already dead. Who cares?
So you know,
desecrate.
You get to satisfy that bloodlust without actually having to think about your actions.
Mm-hmm. And it, well, and it's also like part of the, that came also with games like Silent Hill.
Mm.
You know, I think Silent Hill is well, I guess we'd probably say Resident Evil created its own little mini genre, didn't it? Of survival horror with isometric views, where you're getting puzzles and collecting items, making guns, and there's always the you know, I think it was it you that said that, where it's like the difference between an action game and a horror game is ammo scarcity.
Yeah.
So if a game gives you a lot of ammo, it's not really that scary of a game.
Right. Right. Whereas, you always have like some sort of like method of defense. So you're not worried about, you know, if you retraverse through an area, you're not worried about like, okay, what if the zombies have repopulated, or what if something else pops out of a window at me?
Or like you're using a knife to go at their legs in the attempt to bring them down. To prevent having to use actual bullets.
Which is funny, because the Resident Evil game that makes like the best use of that knife is Code Veronica, which is one of the Resident Evil games with the least ammo scarcity.
Yeah,
like there are bullets coming out the walls in that game.
Wait a minute. Which Resident Evil... I love the whole series. Which Resident Evil game are we talking about?
Two.
Okay, so 2 is probably my favorite. Like, so the first Resident Evil... is fantastic. You know, they're going to that mansion that's kind of out in the woods, and you've got 2 different STARS teams that are kind of sent in to investigate. Turns out this guy Wesker, who looks like he's a shady character, is in fact a shady character. And he's been experimenting on himself with the, let's call it, mutagen. It's kind of like Ninja Turtles, in a way. No, but
it's a crossover we need.
Yeah. It turns out they've been doing some kind of experiments in the lab, in this lab that they have there. Trying to create, which strain of the virus is it? T virus, yeah. And then there's this evil corporation called Umbrella.
Yeah,
behind the whole thing.
Yeah, they're like a pharmaceutical company who, you know, they're always the villains.
Yeah,
just like in real life. And
oh man, paralleling right now, Pfizer. I bet you Pfizer's making the G virus right now.
Yeah, maybe. we're months away from the zombie apocalypse.
Oh man, isn't this gonna be so fucked up? It's like, oh, we thought we all had the flu, and then like. Come May, when like the antivirus is all over the place and everyone's good, it's like then everyone's skin starts itching.
God,
you know, and everyone's like, oh, huh, I'm suddenly craving brains. Which would be a bizarre trope for zombies, that zombies like to eat brains,
right? You know? And I'm not exactly sure where that came from, because you know, any zombie film that you see, it's always like they just crave flesh; they just want to eat.
Right.
The living. Mm-hmm. But then that trope remains, like, though they specifically want the brains.
Yeah. By the way, Return of the Living Dead is one of my all-time favorite zombie movies. I think it's one of the best horror films.
Which one is Return?
It's the one that George Romero hates.
Is that the one where they're...
It's a punk band, is on the road, and they end up spilling... Again, it's some kind of chemical. Ends up getting spilled in a cemetery, and all of the bodies get reanimated.
I don't think I saw that one.
Yeah, it's not an official George Romero film, and he got really mad that they made it. It was made by somebody kind of tangentially involved with the production of it. It came out in the early 80s. It's even gorier than Dawn of the Dead by far. It's super fucking gory. Actually, I shouldn't say by far. Dawn of the Dead's got some gore in it. Some legit scary, like, violent stuff. But it's also very comical. It's also a very dark humor associated with all of it. Like... Even to the point where some of, like, the lines in it, you know, like, literally, like, the ambulances arrive, and then, like, the ambulances get swarmed by zombies, and they're now, you know, there's literally this one scene where it's, like, one of the paramedics is in there literally eating out of someone's, like, eating the skull of someone, just, like it's a bowl eating it, and then, like, the voice comes over the thing where it's, like, and it's like, respond, respond, we can't hear you, respond. And then the zombie's just like, send more paramedics. it's such a funny line.
what an interesting evolving franchise, you know, despite Romero's involvement. And I think there was some sort of dispute, like, of the Living Dead sort of property, where there's some difficulty if it like is something that could be copywritten or not.
I want to say there's a director named Fulci that made a series called Zombie, like Zombi, and made a ton of installments. I mean, it's not really the sort of thing you can. He shouldn't have a copyright, in my opinion. I don't know.
The concept of reanimated corpses. No,
because
I think like Mary Shelley would have something to say about that.
Yeah, right. It would be like somebody saying, but they own werewolves.
Right. Right.
Or, you know, whatever. So.
And eventually it all passes into public domain anyway.
Oh, okay. So to Resident Evil 2.
Yes.
Yeah, so Resident Evil 2 picks up, not at the mansion, but in a town called Raccoon City in USA, America.
Mm-hmm.
I guess they don't really indicate what state it is. It's supposed to be just somewhere in the middle of the U.S.
I think it's supposed to be like a sort of Midwest.
Yeah.
Sort of take like maybe even Appalachia.
Yeah.
Kind of area. Because I think like they're called the Arklay Mountains. I don't know if that's an actual geographic place.
Probably not.
Anyway.
That sounds like something they didn't want to associate with an actual location.
Mm.
But at any rate, like, yeah. So, what your main characters are Leon, who is this cop that's just been enlisted in Raccoon PD. And then you've got Claire Redfield, who is the sister of Chris,
right,
who you would know from the first game.
Oh. And Claire Redfield, objective best character in the franchise.
Yeah. I'll let you have that. I'm not going to fight you on that one.
Okay.
You know, there's some good characters, though.
Yeah.
Rebecca Chambers, she's got her place.
Yeah, sure. Brad,
Ada
the helicopter pilot.
Yeah, Brad Wesker. Vickers, his name's Vickers. Brad
right.
Vickers. Yeah, he's cool. And Leon's cool. I like Ada Wong.
Mm-hmm.
Fun characters. You know, and again, this is like this is the heyday of the Resident Evil franchise. They've made, I think, like 7 installments, like a mainline title
right.
installments. I think they're up to 7.
Yep.
And they've had many, many different offshoot games that have come up over the years. I know there's like the Chronicles series.
Yeah, the light gun shooters on Wii. I mean, even like Code yeah. Veronica, not a numbered game. And, you know, we'll talk about that game in greater detail when that comes up appropriate chronologically. But
yeah.
And then you have like the Survivor games, Raccoon City. There's a big one that I'm forgetting, and it's totally slipping my mind. But yeah,
quick side note: 1996, the arcade shooter House of the Dead comes out.
Yes,
I love that game.
Mm-hmm.
Brutally hard, like just a quarter muncher of a game, but man, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah,
not affiliated with Capcom or this, but you know, hey, that was out there.
But one of the more interesting things about Resident Evil 2 is that, of course, they put you in a similar setting. And the first one, you're in a mansion, and in the second one, they put you into the Raccoon City police station.
Who built that fucking police station? My God.
Right. I think there's some sort of, like, a backstory to where it was, like, some sort of a library or museum that got retrofit into a police station at some point. Like, and the chief also had an appreciation for grotesque art as well as taxidermy.
Yeah.
So it kind of, like, explains a sort of a weird decor for a police station in there.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know too many police stations that have a library.
I also don't know how many have underground laboratories.
Right.
another thing.
So they... And it adopts, of course, the similar like progression structure of the original Resident Evil. You are going through the police station. You are discovering keys and trinkets that will allow you to access different parts of the station.
Yeah.
And the objective is just kind of basically to just sort of... unravel the web and get to like your end point. And I think
kind of like when you're watching a bad cartoon and you can tell that there's a background and then there's something drawn on top of it and that doesn't quite mesh well. That's kind of how the interactables are in the game. I mean, just it actually helps you in that, so you can kind of know what is and isn't an interactable, because otherwise you're sitting there tapping A at every single desk or whatever,
right.
You know? But yeah, that does stick out. You'll notice ammo will stick out. Usually if it's a closet you're supposed to open or something, it'll look a little little shinier, I guess you could say.
Yeah, some things even like sparkle.
Yeah, there's usually glitter on useful things.
And then there are also just hidden things as well. So, you know, there is some benefit, like if you're being a completionist, to going around and clicking on every desk just to see if like, there's maybe like a drawer with some handgun bullets in there or something. Because...
Mm-hmm.
Ammo is scarce. They maintain that sort of scarcity.
Yep.
There are more weapons that you can acquire in this game as opposed to the first one. Also, there are sort of like weapon specifics. So in this game, in the first one, you did get to choose between Chris and Jill, and you had a few differences in the game depending on what character you took.
Yeah.
In Resident Evil 2, it's split into two halves. So in the first half, you get to pick your character, and then... you finish the game, but then you sort of like get to play the other side of that coin as the opposite character.
Really cool.
Yeah, you'll start in a different place. You'll have to move through the mansion in a different order. You'll find things out there, more difficult enemies that have populated it from the beginning.
Well, also, and I don't remember if this was exactly this way, but I know that like Claire's storyline involves Sherry Birkin a lot, the little girl, and Leon's storyline involves Ada a lot. I don't know if that ever crossovered, but you always have like these little mini missions you have to do.
Right.
With the other character.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of times in each scenario we have to swap over to their partner. And of course, like if you're playing, I think the canonical, I haven't played all versions of it recently in several years. I played through Claire A, Leon B scenarios, which I believe is the canonical sort of like narrative. This is how like it's supposed to be played out and like how those sequels are going to reference it. Claire teams up with Sherry and then Leon with Ada. And, you know, when you're playing through Claire A, you have to play as Sherry a couple of times. And she's slower, of course, smaller, and doesn't use any weapons. So there are a couple of points you're just having to, like, avoid dogs, which is real annoying. Yeah. But when you're playing as Leon, you switch over to Ada. She does, of course, have a weapon. She's an adult, so she moves faster. So, you know, that you can eliminate enemies that are in your way. But when you're
playing... But being that she's a woman, she has 70% of the ammo that the man would have.
Right, right. And it takes more of her bullets to actually take down the enemies, too. So yeah, they're just immediate disadvantage.
Yeah. Her womanly arms just aren't as strong enough.
She can't, like, push the bullets forward.
Yeah, exactly.
But, so, when you're playing as Ada, you get to do some more of these action sequences. But I'm not sure if you're doing, like, Leon A, Claire B, if it swaps those partner characters. I don't remember.
Okay, yeah. I was thinking that I wasn't sure. I thought they might, but...
The game itself doesn't take too much time to play through. Like, I played through Claire Scenario A, and I clocked in at 4 hours. And that was, like, I remembered a few things, like, you know, where to use the gems that you find. Yeah. But, like, there were some things that I had completely forgotten about. So... You know, even going in, you know, partially blind, it still does not take very long to get through. Which, you know, I think because the game gives you so much to do, it's to its credit that it doesn't take very long to play through. Because you're unlocking things as you go. There are different modes, like Fourth Survivor that you unlock. There are, like, arrange mode games where, you know, you play through as a character and you get, like, infinite ammo and your objective. Like, you're not really doing any puzzle solving. It takes more of, like, an action game sort of setup. And you unlock more.
Oh, yeah. It's like you just go to your chest and it's got every weapon in the game stacked with all the ammo you could want.
Yep.
You know?
Yep. So, you know, if you're just like doing like a quick like hour playthrough or you just want to like blast away some zombies with a machine gun with infinite ammo, you know, a range game. Well, there's tons of different modes and difficulty levels.
Well, even within just the mainline game itself, the items you pick up scale the difficulty.
Mm.
So it's the sort of thing where, you know, just because you see a really nice weapon doesn't necessarily mean you should pick it up.
Right.
Because it means that now the game is going to spawn potentially harder bad guys down the road for you. Like, I remember one of the optimal, because like that was what I was doing on this forum, was going through optimal speed runs of fucking Resident Evil 2. But that was one of the things that they brought up where they were like, you know, aside from your pistol, really the only gun you absolutely want to get is the Magnum and the Magnum upgrade. Then that's it.
Like, yeah, if you're playing as Leon, because Claire doesn't get the Magnum. Yeah. She gets the grenade launcher.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and I think it's like a... There's like an electricity gun. It's like a yellowish kind of gun with these forks. From what I remember, and I don't know all the specifics of it anymore, but that was the worst item in the world to pick up. Because it spawned tons and tons of bad guys down the road. And you really couldn't really make good use. Even if you hit with every single round that could be acquired for it, there were more things spawned than that weapon would take out.
Yeah, I know that gun you're talking about. It also takes up 2 slots in your inventory. It is slow. And I did pick it up because I had completely forgotten about the difficulty scaling. And also, it's hidden. It's like you like have to like examine a specific corpse. And I did, and I found it. And I was like, okay, I'll take this extra gun. And then I used it like 3 or 4 times. Like, this thing is goddamn useless. And I put it away forever.
Yeah, and again, it doesn't make the game impossible by picking it up. It just impedes your progress through the game to, you know, when really the thing you want is just kind of the most efficient weapons to kill and then some healing items.
Right, and that's one of the really fun things about Resident Evil, and I think, again, this game being so brief is to its benefit here, is figuring out the process. Like, I want to do things in this order and pick up these things in these places in order to get through this thing, like, in the most efficient way possible.
Yeah.
And I really like that sort of thing.
Again, yeah, if you backtrack a bunch through rooms, you're really just making life harder for yourself.
Yep. And, you know, I'm the type of person when I play these Resident Evil games where I want to pick up every herb. And you're going to be cluttering up your inventory if you do that. So, you know, yes, if you're trying to be super efficient, not every health item needs to be picked up as soon as you see
it. True, and you really don't need it all. And, you know, just picking up a handful of those herbs and then combining them together to make the healing things is, you know, don't plan on taking that much damage that you need all of those.
Right.
The whole idea is really, you know, you don't want to engage in every fight. Mm-hmm. You want to tactically avoid things as best as you possibly can. That's the best encounter is simply to dodge something and then get out of the room.
And there are pretty specific points in the game where, you know, clearly the game wants you just to like work your way around. Like the zombies aren't directly in your path, so just maneuver around. Like the beginning especially, they hit you with so many zombies, there's no way you're going to have enough bullets to take out every single one of them.
That's probably some clever game design just right off the bat to kind of get you used to this isn't Duke Nukem.
Right.
Like don't go around thinking you're going to kill everything.
Yeah. As you're going through that opening section in Raccoon City, it's pretty explicitly showing like, this is the way the game is supposed to be played. You're not going to mode on everything in your path.
Mm-hmm. I think it's an economy of the time. They couldn't fully 3D render everything.
Right.
But the use of the static cameras in certain positions kind of lends to the atmosphere of it and creates tension. Not knowing what's around every corner, kind of just being in a room and then hearing things. The sound design is great for such an old game. It kind of keeps you like, you know, every time you hear something, it just literally, and again, camera's also static too, so you're hearing like tapping on a window or something as you're walking through a hallway of just windows. And you're just like, fuck this. It makes you kind of just like scared to even move forward. Like, maybe it's like the sort of like, was there ever a game before this that you would genuinely call scary? Like, that you play personally? Like, I think
that. Not that I can remember.
The games are so, oftentimes, like SNES games or NES games, they're all so low res. That is it can you even really make those games scary? But then you play a game like Resident Evil, which feels like a little miniature horror movie. Looking back on it now, it's so pixelated and all that, but you're sort of like, okay, whatever. But
I think that Resident Evil, especially early on, always found really smart ways to give you that sort of tension that, of course, you associate with horror. I mean, of course, it does have like the gore and the blood and all that stuff that's also associated with horror and slasher films.
Yeah.
But you know what they're doing is like what the camera angles do is they deliberately mask information, whereas other games, like they want to give you this information, like here's the situation that you're in, figure it out. Whereas, you know, in Resident Evil, you don't know what might happen if you go down the hallway where you hear the tapping, or you know, if you pull the plug in the bathtub and the water drains, it's like something's gonna pop out at you.
Yeah.
So you know, deliberately keeping the players in the dark, you know, you have that fear of the unknown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's expertly crafted on the part of this game. And again, building on what they did in Resident Evil, but
yeah,
you know, and I think you brought that up with Code Veronica, where Code Veronica, it does have that same kind of tension and all that, but clearly there is a move to want to make this more of an action game, or at least incorporate some parts of the game that feel more action oriented, like she's dual wielding guns and shit, like. You know.
Yeah, and you also see that transition happen. Like I'm a bit of a skewed point of reference here because I did also play through the original.
Oh, Jill Valentine's the best character.
No. Agree to disagree.
What? Has to be Jill.
No, it's Claire.
She's such a crucial component to all of it.
True.
You know?
So, the I've been playing through... I played through the remake. The GameCube remake. I actually played it on Switch. I picked it up on a discount a while back. I played through that a couple of times, so I'm coming from a place where the original Resident Evil, in terms of the remake, is much more of a tangled web, where you know you have essentially your keys you're using in more multiple places. Whereas in Resident Evil 2, you have a key. I think it's the heart key you use in a place, and then it's useless. So. It's a more of an intricate...
But you're moving statues and you're getting emblems. And
yeah, it's true.
They have like, all kinds of other wonky little puzzles that you have to solve.
There are certainly puzzles in Resident Evil 2, but I think that much more there's a stronger emphasis on action in 2 than there is in at least the remake of 1. And of course, like that, it's sort of a backwards way of looking at it because the remake of 1 comes after 2. But, you know, I would still like put it at like 30% action, 70% puzzle solving. And I think that, like, as the series goes on, you kind of feel that balance definitely shift, and by the time you get to Resident Evil 4, it's almost all action.
Oh, what if they made like Resident Evil Leaf 2, or like, you know, Alpha Green, or like kind of just made it, but then added more, and like once you beat it, you unlock part of Resident Evil 3. You know, just kind of Pokemon it up.
Yeah, you know,
come up with some really clever shit there. I think that would be fun.
I think it would be really great if they, because they did remake Resident Evil 2 and 3.
Resident Evil, like Black. What were the sequels of Black and White?
Black 2, White 2. Resident Evil 2, 2.
Bingo. Right? Shit writes itself, man.
I think it would be really great if they did a sort of retro style remake, because they did remake Resident Evil 2 and 3 as these action games.
Great acclaim, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
People love the shit out of that. Which is nice, like, you know, I love that game forever. Like, it's kind of, it's really cool seeing people go back and revisit and be like, wow, this was a fantastic game.
True. What I would really love to see is, in addition to those remakes, also do a remake that's just the original style, updated graphics, and added content. Like, I love my puzzle solving.
That seemed, I feel like they could do that and just use isometric cameras the whole time and stuff like that. Yeah, that's it. I don't see why not.
I think that the fixed camera angles are such a crucial component to the tension, like we were talking about. And then also, like, I think the sort of tank controls were always a really smart way to interface with that game, because with a constant, like, camera angle changing, you don't ever want to run into a situation where, you know, you're moving your character one way, camera angles change, and then all of a sudden your character gets disoriented and, like, maybe flips you back to a different camera angle just because you accidentally backtracked. Mm-hmm. So I think, like, having those tank controls, you know, while they feel wonky at first, the longer you play them, the more you get used to them. Like, you know, as long as I hold up, I know I'm going to be moving forward even if the camera angle changes.
Yeah. I was actually recently watching somebody play, and it's such a clever touch. Playing some new horror game that came out called, like, 1,000 Floors or something like that, and it's literally 1,000 rooms, and you're basically trapped in this mansion, and you got to literally go through 1,000 rooms without getting killed. And they're all super low res and shit. But there just comes a point, like every 50 or so rooms, it's the Resident Evil door change where it's like, you know what I'm talking about? Where it's all black walls and then you just hear the door like creak open and then you walk through the door.
Yep.
Every 50-ish rooms. Not a lot. You didn't see it happen a lot.
We got to mask a load screen. How are we going to do it? Let's do the Resident Evil door.
I know. It was just such a great touch.
So speaking of those doors, there are a few differences in the N64 version, specifically the doors actually move a little bit faster because it's a cartridge, so it doesn't need to, it doesn't have to combat with the sort of load times that you would on a disc.
Yeah.
I
mean, Leon's hairdo alone is probably like a 5-second load.
You get to a higher res version than the PS1 version because of the RAM expansion on the N64, the little slot in front that you put the RAM expansion into. There's an item randomizer mode, which will just kind of scatter things in different order so you can play through.
Very cool.
That way, which is kind of cool. You can adjust the amount of blood and gore and also change the blood color if, you know, you want.
What are my options?
There's just kind of like a primitive slider bar how much like blood and gore there are, and I think you can change the blood to green.
Oh, green would be kind of interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There are in-game files, like, you know, those files that you pick up that give you a bit of story, that reference the game that would eventually become Resident Evil Zero, because, I'll put a pin in that, we'll get back to it. Okay. There are a few things that it does not have. Like, it does have, like, the fourth survivor mode and a couple of, like, the A and B story for every character. So it has some of the extra stuff, like a lot of the content that's in the PS1 version, but it doesn't have the arrange game mode. Because it just couldn't fit it. They took a game that was like two discs, and I think it was like a gigabyte on the PS1, and they compressed it down to a singularity almost, for like, turned into like 64 megabytes on the N64 cartridge.
Wow.
So, you know, they really compressed this game down, and like the cutscenes are still intact, the voice acting is still intact. It's not as good quality voice acting. In terms of like the sound fidelity, the voice acting is just terrible in general. In terms of the quality of the performances,
well, they're not without its charm.
Well, it's true.
It's charmingly bad in a way. You know, people kind of like, I remember that was what they were doing, is that they would mash up vocal, or like they would take all of the clips and then like make little mini stories just using the voice, all the voices out of context and things like that. Because there's some really weird stuff that happens in there.
Yep. So yeah, that's the biggest omission from the N64 game, but it's super impressive that they were able to make this work on the N64.
Yeah.
And we haven't really talked about the sort of objective stuff yet. This game was published and developed by Capcom. This was the first Capcom game on the N64.
There was never a Mega Man game?
There was a Mega Man game after this. This is the first... Capcom made two N64 games. This and Mega Man Legends.
Holy shit.
This is They finally showed up to the party.
I gotta look at the roster here for Marvel vs. Capcom 2, because like...
It was not on N64.
Oh, I mean, that game came out on the Dreamcast.
Right.
So that had to be like around the same time.
Yeah, I think Marvel vs. Capcom 2 was in early 2000.
Yeah, you're right. Very, very good on knowing that. Yeah, correct.
Whoa, no. Well, Capcom makes Street Fighter.
Yeah. Never a Street Fighter game on N64.
Oh,
did not show up.
God. Yeah,
the N64 was not a well-selling system in Japan.
This is like that part of the mystery movie where I've put everything together and I've realized that all of this is a lie.
Right.
You know.
So it was one of the big challenges of the N64. We talked about this, you know, back when we talked about the launch of the N64. So many Japanese developers especially jumped ship and went over to the PlayStation because a bunch of different reasons. One of the major reasons was just the use of discs rather than cartridges. It was a cheaper format.
Yeah.
And they actually had more storage on disc rather than on an N64 cartridge. So
yeah,
it became the default system to go to. But, you know, I guess eventually Capcom decided that they put Resident Evil 2 on the system. And actually, Resident Evil 2 was originally announced for the N64 as part of like a 4-game exclusivity deal between Nintendo and Capcom. And it was like supposed to span two systems, the N64 and the next system that Nintendo would be releasing at the time. They codenamed it the Dolphin.
Yes, the Dolphin.
It would eventually become the GameCube. So, and part of this like exclusivity deal was a Resident Evil 2 port, which seems weird to like say this port is coming out as an N64 exclusive. That's a contradiction.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's going to be a Resident Evil prequel for the N64. That never happened. It eventually became Resident Evil Zero on the GameCube.
And that's Rebecca's character, right?
Right.
I think that focus is from her, but it's again, it's sort of like playing the B story of the Bravo team. She is the B squad.
Right.
Her experience with all that shit.
Yeah, and it basically ends with her getting to the mansion where, you know, she meets up with Chris.
Yeah.
This is where they announced a remake of the first game that would eventually be for the GameCube that was originally...
Oh, do you know that Brad Vickers is actually in Resident Evil 2?
Yes.
I forget what it is. You either need to kill everything or kill nothing.
I think you kill nothing. I think you have to...
Yeah.
Maybe you have to like go into the police station then head back out, maybe.
Yeah, and he's like, there's like an alleyway underneath the building and you go back there and you can see his zombified body.
Yeah you have like a route that you can take. You can like cut through the park or go like underneath this little alleyway, and if you kill him you get the key for the costume closet in the room with the dark room.
Yeah.
And you can switch outfits, and I think also I'm not sure if it works for Leon as well, but you get like a weapon exclusive. You get like a gun that has a faster firing speed, but also only has a 6-bullet capacity.
Oh, okay. That's right. This is all coming back to me.
Yeah. But there was a bunch of different unlockable weapons and costumes and stuff, depending on like how well you play through the game and stuff.
Yeah.
And that sort of thing used to be free. Now it would be DLC. No, they charge you for it.
Quick tangent. Can I go through the Marvel side of the Marvel vs. Capcom 2 roster? I think you might find this funny. Considering what is popular now,
right?
When you think of Marvel characters, Blackheart made the roster.
I have no idea who that is.
Cable.
Good, yeah. That sounds about right.
Captain America, of course. Colossus.
Uh-huh.
Cyclops.
Nice.
Doctor Doom.
Gambit. Colossus. I can't remember. They would have been very close, if not already have killed him off in the comics at that point in 99.
Yeah. So you got the Hulk, of course. That's kind of fitting, but even then, everyone was like, really, the Hulk? Iceman? Iron Man?
God, that is fascinating. Iceman.
Yeah. Iceman was a really good character too. Juggernaut, Magneto, Marrow,
God,
Omega Red, Psylocke, Rogue, Sabretooth, a Sentinel. And the Sentinel is actually a top tier character. It's so overpowered. It's crazy strong. Shuma Goroth?
I don't know that one.
I think it's a big eyeball. It's a green eyeball with like tentacles. Silver Samurai. Do you know that character?
Yep. He crosses paths with Wolverine fairly often. Well, relatively often.
Okay. Spider-Man. Spiral. Storm.
Spiral. Interesting.
Yeah. Thanos. Which... really fitting now. Right. I remember everyone was like, who the fuck is Thanos? Venom, War Machine, and Wolverine, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Spider-Man. That's an interesting roster. There are like no Avengers on that roster.
Right, yeah. I mean, you got Iron Man, you got Hulk, and Captain America.
Yeah, I guess those are some of the, at least two of the big three, yeah. Plus Hulk. You don't have Thor on that roster.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, no Thor or any of like the current popular characters. Like,
No Hawkeye.
I mean, that's a shame, but, you know, understood. Right. I can see why that happened. No Black Widow, no Panther, none of those guys.
So Resident Evil 2.
Sorry, back on this.
I mean, I'm pretty much tapped out. This is a really, really great game. There's a ton of content. You get dozens of hours of gameplay out of this little cartridge. You can get a used cart on Amazon for like $30.
Yeah.
It's all right.
It's real spooky.
Yeah.
Probably should have talked about this a month ago. But what are you going to do?
Oh, that's okay. I had some conflicting information when I was originally looking up release dates for N64 games, you know, months ago. I was looking up the back half of 1999.
Yeah.
I was getting some sources that were saying early November. But now, you know, most places I'm going to now are saying, no, October 31st. Okay. Well.
Fair enough.
That's all right. We only missed it by one day later, and it would have been November. Everyone was probably buying it in November anyway.
Yeah.
A really well-received game. I couldn't find any specific sales figures, but there were some, rumors and hearsay, but there were some rumors and speculation that Capcom did not bring Resident Evil 3 to the N64 because Resident Evil 2 did not sell particularly well on the system.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that was such a cross-platform thing. I mean, I'm sure it was sort of an afterthought that they were going to get some sales there. Resident Evil 3 is a very fun game, too.
Resident Evil 3 also leans even more into the action than Resident Evil 2 did. And it did have like some interesting crafting system with like the different types of gunpowder you can combine to make different bullets.
Ammo and stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the sort of way you could screw yourself over by like, oh, I'm going to make I'm going to save my gunpowder for making really powerful weapons. And then you don't have, you know, enough of just your regular handgun bullets to get past the zombies. Or the inverse of that, you create too much of your handgun bullets, and then you don't have anything powerful to take down any of the major enemies at the end.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is a top tier N64 game. Resident Evil 2 is real good.
It is. It's a really fucking good game. I understand that it's not like one of those like first party Nintendo things, but man, what a wonderful game. Anyway, I think we've spitballed that before, where it's like, man, how did they fuck up the Resident Evil movies so bad? Because I feel like they already had a really cool narrative and story, like the great characters, kind of a good, scary plot. And then they're just like, we're just going to fucking throw it all away.
I'm pretty sure Paul W.S. Anderson never even played one of the games.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Would not be the least bit surprised. I think that they're working on a series. I think they're trying to make a Resident Evil series now.
I think you might be right.
And it's I don't think it has anything to do with God bless her, Mila Jovovich, great actress. Why did you do that?
Now she's doing Monster Hunter with her husband.
Really?
Yeah, there's going to be a Monster Hunter movie. Wow. It looks like it has nothing to do with Monster Hunter.
Man.
He just always loves to give her work where she just like kills a bunch of shit. Like, yeah. I'm just going to go get real bloody and mow things down.
Yeah, and again, this is something that came up. I saw a list of actresses that have killed the most people, and she's like clearly number one, just like double the kill count of number two. Just nonstop murder machine, that woman.
Yeah. So, one other game briefly before we move on to some other stuff. Rayman 2, The Great Escape came out Also, conflicting sources here with release dates. Some are saying anywhere from like October 29th to November 2nd.
Yeah.
This one was developed and published by Ubisoft at the time. The development side was called Ubi Pictures, and the publishing side was called Ubisoft, weirdly enough. It's a 3D platformer. It looks pretty cool. So I want to bank this one for a different show. We'll get back to it. This is also $30, around the ballpark of $30 used on Amazon. Just kind of a magic number, because the last game we're going to talk about later on is also $30 used on Amazon.
Huh. I don't know when the timing of it was, but it looks like it also did at some point come out on a 3DS.
Yes.
Yeah, and the regular DS.
There was a port, or I guess it was sort of a remake for it, that got brought to the DS in, I think it was 2005.
That's wild. This game is like 8 different consoles you could have purchased this game on.
Yeah, because it came out with the PS1, also comes out on the Dreamcast later on, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's a the original Rayman was a 2D side-scroller, and I don't know too much about the franchise, but then the most recent entries in the franchise, which are Rayman Origins and Rayman Legends, are back to 2D platformers.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, some movies. Want to talk about some movies?
Let's do it, man. What came out?
Pokemon the first movie.
Oh, are you kidding me?
Was November 6th.
Whoa. Is that the moment with Mewtwo?
Yes.
Mewtwo has that speech that Herman Cain quoted?
Oh, right. May he rest in peace.
Yeah, rest in peace. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember too much about this movie. Like, this would be one of the big benefits to having Wes here at the time, because I'm sure...
The one where Pikachu's, like, slapping himself over and over again.
Is that a thing that happens in that movie?
Yeah, there's, like, because I think Mewtwo spawns, like the same Pokemon that Ash has, but, like, the mean ones, the bad ones. And then, like... The mean Pikachu is like slap, just like literally bitch slapping him. But then the Pikachu's trying to do the whole stoic strong thing, like, and then, you know, making the other Pikachu feel bad.
Huh.
You know, which is kind of a shitty way to win a fight, but I think it kind of worked.
Well, you know, it's a kid's movie, so you don't want to have too much violence, I suppose.
There's a conspiracy theory that, who's the little dork from the third game?
Wally?
That Wally is the main character, and you're like, that there's this kind of, I don't know if it's a conspiracy theory, but like, there's this way that you can read the events of the story where you're the side story.
Mm.
And that what Wally's journey is the real journey of the game.
Well, you know, and the sort of like, if you want to take that perspective, Wally is sort of the Red of Gen 1, where, you know, he's the, like, the scrappy underdog.
Yeah.
And you... In
Big Dick Powerhouse. Like
I don't know the canonical name of the character in Ruby Sapphire, but you're Blue / Gary. Like you're like the unstoppable force is just knocking everybody out.
Yeah,
I think like the major difference is like you're also the one taking down like the sort of gangster squad, whereas you know Blue didn't have much to do with Team Rocket in Gen 1. He just kind of encountered them and like hung out where they were hanging out in like the Silco building.
Yeah, right.
And it didn't do anything to stop them. It was just totally complicit with what was happening there.
Oh, makes you ask who is the bad guy, really? You
know? I think that's the most we've ever spent talking about a Pokemon story. And we have a podcast dedicated to it.
Well, you hate story. That's the thing about it.
I do. It's silly for this reason.
What the
it's
fucking
silly.
Kind of story are we going to talk about? Where that swimmer keeps her Pokeballs? Like, what's the grand narrative of all of it, you know?
Right. But yeah, Rayman. Oh, no. Pokemon, the first movie. That's what we're talking about.
Yeah.
I did not see this movie in theaters, did you?
I know I've seen one Pokemon movie that's not the recent one with Ryan Reynolds.
Mm.
And yeah, it was fine, but I kind of just don't care about the whole, this is, we love Pokemon so much, but this is just one aspect of it that it's just like, I can't really say I care all that much.
Yeah, this came out, and I think by the time the movie came out, like I really wasn't paying much attention to the cartoon anymore either. Like at a certain point, like I was pretty much strictly just playing the game.
I remember liking the first season, that first original season of the cartoon, and enjoying it. But I didn't follow any beyond that. And I feel like if I tried to pick it up, I probably would be really bored.
Hmm.
I hate to say it. Looking back on it, it's like there are some funny storylines. Like, why does the guy that's abusing Charmander sound Australian? You know, like, why was that a choice? Does Australia exist in Kanto? You know, or like the guy that's like torturing his Sandshrew to make it a better fighter.
Oh shit!
Like that's like straight up animal abuse.
Huh.
Yeah, he's got him in this like weird thing that he has to like try. He's trying to break out of it, and it hurts him if he tries to. Okay. Yeah, it's pretty it's not very nice.
Hmm.
Certainly not nice.
So yeah, November 12th.
Yeah, what else came out?
Dogma, Kevin Smith movie.
That's a great movie. The cast on that is unreal.
Yeah.
Take
us through. Who's Ben Affleck?
Oh yeah, Matt Damon. Matt Damon and Ben Affleck play as Azrael and another angel.
Loki maybe?
Maybe something like that. You've got George Carlin playing a priest.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it is, who's trying to very comically trying to brand the Catholic faith because it's gone through a lot of shit
with the Buddy Christ.
Yeah, the Buddy Christ thing. You've got the actor that he passed away, I think. He plays Snape.
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman's mm-hmm. in it. Linda Fiorentino? Is that her name?
That sounds like it's in the neighborhood.
Something like that. Gosh, I feel bad. I heard she was kind of an asshole, though. I heard there was a lot of fighting on the set.
Okay.
Involving her. Oh, sorry, you said Selma Hayek's in it. She is, in fact, in it.
Chris Rock?
Yeah, Chris Rock is there. What a wonderful cast.
Jason Lee?
Jason Lee plays does he play the devil? He's Lucifer?
No, he's some sort of minion of hell. I don't think you ever encounter like any sort of like actual Satan figure throughout the movie.
Yeah. Now that I look back on it, I'm like literally trying to think of what the plot even was. I think it's just that the two of them are trying to undo all of existence, and Selma Hayek's a stripper or something. And
Selma Hayek, well, they kind of like have this parade of characters. But I haven't seen this movie in years. But yeah. I'm gonna try to summarize the plot. God. Let's start from the actual very beginning of stuff that does get revealed to the end. So spoilers for this fucking 21-year-old movie. God, who is played by Alanis Morissette in the movie, likes to come to Earth and play skee-ball on the Jersey Shore. So while he gets into some sort of accident or a mugging, and he ends up like as he's sort of like transcended into his human form, ends up in a hospital bed. No one knows where God is. Bartleby, that's the name. Bartleby and Loki.
Yes.
Who are played by Matt Damon and Ben Affleck.
Top build on the cast.
They take this opportunity to sort of exploit this loophole, because they've been cast out of heaven, but they're going to exploit this loophole to remove their wings, basically becoming human, and participate in some sort of event that George Carlin is putting on in order to gain forgiveness, which is exclusive to human beings. Angels can't be forgiven. So they'll become human, get forgiveness, and get to go back to heaven. And in doing so, they will have called into question God's infallibility.
Mm-hmm.
And God's not around to just go ahead and stop them. So because if God is no longer infallible, it sort of like collapses the universe. So Alan Rickman is trying to stop them through the character of Linda, what's her face?
Fiorentino, I got it. Actually, that was her name.
I forget why she is like, I forget why she's like the sort of protagonist character, like what her role in it is, it like why she was the one who's chosen, like you got to stop these guys. But then you have like the other like side characters who come in to help. Jay and Silent Bob show up. Selma Hayek's there to help her. Chris Rock, who's the 13th apostle, is there to help her. And then she just kind of gets this entourage, like we need to get to this church before they do and not let them pull off this scheme that they're trying to pull off.
Yeah. She, I remember correctly, she worked at an abortion clinic. That was her. Again, this is probably just a lot of writing intending to be as blasphemous as possible.
Hmm.
What's weird is that it's also so well informed of Christianity. You can tell that Kevin Smith grew up Catholic.
And, yeah.
He's definitely influenced by a lot of this. And he wanted to make a movie that sort of like, you know, no literal sacred cows permitted. But at the same time, kind of accurately captured a kind of key core component that a lot of people that have a crisis of faith have to grapple with at some point.
Mm.
Which is the notion of, you know, infallibility and original sin and all that stuff. It's just found a very dick and fart joke way of going about it.
Right.
You know?
My favorite thing about this movie is actually something that's not in the movie, is that, you know, of course, whenever you have any sort of movie that pokes fun at a very, what was typically viewed as like very like pious subjects.
Yeah.
You know, the people that protest, and there are people that protested this movie. One of them being the film's director, Kevin Smith. he went to a protest.
Genius.
And protested the premiere of his own movie. They got to pick a sign and everything. He got interviewed. He got interviewed for the, and like, of course, the reporter didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
But he got interviewed, like, oh, why are you protesting this movie? And you can go find that interview on YouTube of him trying to stop his own movie's release.
Yeah. Kevin Smith is just such a really weird filmmaker, I guess. Yeah. I don't know what to say about him. He is, at the same time, he makes some of the most lowbrow, cheaply made movies.
Mm-hmm.
He also makes some of the most inventive and forward-thinking and avant-garde films. Like, it's so... Some of his choices that he makes when it comes to doing a movie... They're really, like, I don't know what to say about him. Is he kind of like Spike Lee, maybe? I really don't know who to compare him to. He's got his own thing.
Yeah, I don't know who to compare him to either. I mean, he also, you know, for some reason, when he was made, like, early on in his filmmaking career, also had, like, these movies that had, like, very thin connections to his other movies. Like, they would drop lines, like, okay. Like,
oh, very Coen Brothers-esque. He kind of has... They just like to recast certain people. It's almost like he has his own cinematic universe.
Right, right. Know? And that's exactly where I was going with that. It's like, because in movies like Mallrats, Chasing Amy, yeah. Even Dogma, they'll make reference to, like, something that they talked about in Clerks.
Yeah. Like, Jay and Silent Bob, too. Like, he made those Jay and Silent Bob movies. My God.
Yeah.
I saw the second one, too, that he made just a year. Like, so Jay and Silent Bob came back in 2001. He was really on a streak here, man. But yeah, Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was the film he made after Dogma. And that was just a total send-up of every cliche about filmmaking possible. Mm. Like, he's just making fun of the industry itself when he makes a movie like that.
Oh, my favorite part of... Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back is Good Will Hunting 2, Hunting Season.
Oh my God, yeah, that is so great. Again, I can't believe we got these guys to do that. I can't believe like these two like Oscar winning actors,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I guess it's just because he's tight with them and, you know, they got their kind of...
Well, you know, Affleck and Damon won for writing before they won for acting.
True, fair point. Yeah. And also, like, there was a lot of bad blood, as I understand there was a lot of bad blood for a bit there between him and Ben Affleck.
Oh, yeah?
He actually has you'd probably love it. He has a really good podcast called Fat Man on Batman.
Hmm.
He's been making, I don't know if he still makes it, but he was making it for years. I listened to it probably like 5 or 6 years ago. And what he would do is he would get interviews with all of these really famous people associated with the property of Batman under the umbrella of Batman. So, like, he got Mark Hamill, because Mark Hamill was the voice actor for the Joker. He got Bruce Timm, Paul Dini, who made the animated series. You know, he just get everybody associated with any component of it he could. Sometimes no names that I'd ever heard of that were just like, this guy wrote for Batman for 5 years in the 80s or something like that. You know, just like all these people, because he really cares a lot about Batman. And that was like he brought it up a couple of times, and I think it really pissed off Ben Affleck that Ben Affleck wouldn't go on his show. Because he kind of refused to be interviewed for whatever reason. I think he's probably a little hung up about that one film. Didn't he make a film with him and his then wife, Jennifer Lopez? Or did they make their own movie?
Sure. Jersey Girl or something?
Yeah, that's what it was. And that was like kind of they got made fun of for that. So maybe there was something there. But
or was it Geely? I don't know. He made so many shit movies.
Yeah. But he actually does eventually come on the show.
Oh, good.
Or, I mean, sorry, he doesn't come on the show. Maybe he does. They seem to have patched it up.
But eventually bury the hatchet.
Yeah, he's in the 2019 film, the Jay and Silent Bob 2, good. Essentially, nice. The reboot. Because I was wondering, like, I wonder if they're even going to mention, because they're kind of, like, not really bringing him up. And then he has this huge reveal at the end.
Hmm.
Maybe in the same way that there's a huge reveal of a character at the end of Dogma, you get a similar reveal. So, yeah. We got a lot of mileage out of this, man. I didn't intend to talk this much about Kevin Smith.
Yeah, neither did I. But, Dogma, like, and Kevin Smith movies in general, like, I tend to like most of them, but none of them I would, maybe only a handful I would call, like, good films, you know?
Yeah, Clerks. Clerks is a great film.
Yeah, I really like Clerks.
Very cleverly directed, and the dialogue is fantastic. The characters are fascinating. They're so natural with mm-hmm. everything they do. It's like I hate to use the term, but it's literally a whole little subgenre film now called mumblecore,
right?
Which is very very much about not really focusing on a narrative as much as it is focusing on dialogue and character interactions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah.
So, real quick before we move on to some other stuff here, I'm not going to spend too much time on comics. I will mention that there was we're still kind of in X-Men, in the X-Men universe. They're still sort of building up to an event called The 12. We'll get to that in a later show. But there was a miniseries that released with issue number 1 in November of 99 called X-Men Children of the Atom. And this was a look back at how the original five X-Men got recruited by Xavier. And there had been X-Men comics to this point that did take a look back at the original team of X-Men. There was X-Men The Hidden Years, which kind of covered material that there's like a dark period of X-Men comics where they stopped publishing new ones, but instead they did reprints of old ones. There was about a 3-year gap. And the Hidden Years comics were sort of like telling, okay, this is what was actually happening when we weren't printing original material.
Oh, okay.
And there was also, I can't remember what it was called, but it was Chris Claremont doing sort of side stories and kind of using it as a way to sort of retcon things. And I forget what the series was called, but basically, like, one of the biggest things that came out of it is around the time when Marvel wanted to resurrect Jean Grey after Chris Claremont killed her off in the Dark Phoenix saga at the end of that. They had to sort of explain how it is that Jean was actually able to be resurrected. And you get, like, the most detailed explanation of that in this retcon that Chris Claremont does in, God, what is this thing called? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Children of the Atom is even further back than all that. It's before any of the original X-Men get recruited, so you get to kind of see who they were before they start attending Xavier's school, and he sort of adopts them all. You get to see, like, Cyclops as a sort of Oliver Twist character where he is being used to commit these petty crimes because he, like, has the power to shoot the concussive blast out of his eyes. He's, like, really skinny and malnourished and, like, in these, like, tattered clothes and stuff. Really, really, like, disheveled character at the beginning there. You get to see Beast as this high school football star who's also, like, a prize student. Like, he's got it made.
Yeah.
And kind of the journey he has to go through when he's sort of outed as being a mutant. Angel is a already aspiring superhero. He flies around at night, calls himself the Avenging Angel, and he, like, saves people from burning buildings and simple shit like that. And Bobby Drake...
But fires he starts first.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Like, he has to commit the arson and save people from it. Bobby Drake is...
Just blowing dudes. Right? I figure that's his backstory.
Well, he's going through, like, the most sort of, like, radical transformations. He is constantly, like, the most you see of him is, like, huddled up in his room because he feels like he's freezing to death all the time. And his parents, like, are constantly, like, seeing, like, ice forming on his door. And they're always like, maybe if we ignore this, it'll go away.
I see. So maybe there's, like, some, Frozen crossover?
Yeah, maybe.
Sort of thing, right? Yeah.
I could see Iceman doing some musical theater.
That'd be cool. Yeah, I mean, it's built for, like, ice skating.
Yeah.
You know, so,
So you get to see this sort of, like, a radicalization of some side characters who are recruited into, like, some anti-mutant hysteria groups.
Oof.
There's also, you get to see, like, Mr. Sinister. He makes a brief appearance where he tries to recruit Angel.
With his soul patch?
How you only see his red glowing eyes and like a silhouette.
Okay. It's probably there though.
Yeah, you know it's him, but you don't get to see the soul patch.
Okay.
And the miniseries ends with them being at the school and then Jean arriving at the school for the first time. So that's kind of where the original run of comics picks up, where she first joins.
Like, don't you think calling him Mr. Sinister really takes the wind out of the sails?
Yes.
Indeed, why couldn't he just be called Sinister?
Right. You know what? And now that I think of it, I think it was...
You know?
I think it was the animated series who first referred to him as Mr. Sinister. I think before that, in the comics, he was just Sinister.
With his incredible power, too.
Yeah.
Didn't even think to get, like, a medical doctorate.
Yeah, not a... And he impersonates a doctor. Like a research scientist who has a doctorate in the comics a number of times.
Jeez.
No, it still
this
goes
is Chris Claremont, right? This sounds like something he'd do.
I don't know. Yeah, I believe it was Claremont who created Sinister.
God.
Yeah, because I think it was Louise Simonson who did Apocalypse. Anyway, neither here nor there.
Yeah, call me Mr. Apocalypse.
Call me Apocalypse JD.
Yeah, right.
Apocalypse Esquire.
Right, like... okay, and he looks so badass, too. Yeah. Guy's ripped, by the way.
Uh-huh.
Like, Mr.
Senor Sinister.
Yeah, right?
All right. A couple more movies before we close it out with the game here. Sleepy Hollow, the Tim Burton Johnny vehicle. Johnny, goddamn it, Johnny Depp vehicle.
John Depp.
Jonathan Depp.
Yes. Timothy Burton and John Depp.
I remember
enjoying this movie.
Yeah, I liked it just fine.
Remember being kind of spooky? Wasn't I think another film involving Christopher Walken?
Yep, Christopher Walken was the Headless Horseman.
Yeah, that was cool.
Had a head for some reason.
Yeah, kind of is not part of the story, but whatever. There's that, I think someone gets impaled and then dragged out of a building.
That sounds about right.
That was a cool kill.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the Demon Barber Fleischer Street without the music.
Yeah. I think it was a perfectly acceptable film.
It was fine, yes.
The World Is Not Enough, James Bond. It was November 19th.
Yeah, I'm looking at the photo, or like the box art for it, and it looks like a joke.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just, it wasn't at the time, of course. Like, yeah, this is the one where they tried to make What's-Her-Face a doctor.
Denise Richards.
Yeah, Denise. Oh, man. The idea was give her some glasses and she's a doctor.
Of course.
You know?
Oh, that's what they should have done with Sinister.
Yeah, that's what he needs.
That's what he was missing.
Maybe a nice hat. Like a Stetson hat. It's like, okay.
I have...
Man About Town, Sinister.
I really have no attachment to the James Bond franchise, and that might have something to do with, you know, the James Bond movies that came out when I was growing up were the Pierce Brosnan ones.
Yeah.
None of them are particularly good.
I think was it Goldfinger?
Well, Goldeneye?
Goldeneye, thank you.
That was the original. Like, yeah. The first Pierce Brosnan one, as far as I remember.
And I liked that one. I thought that one was pretty good. But I think, it got far too bloated, and it became very much about the following things are expected, you know? And it's like, all of it just became so trite.
I can't remember, is this the one with the media guy who is going to take down the world from his boat?
I believe that's right.
Or is that to Tomorrow Never Dies?
I honestly don't know. I'm not sure. They all kind of do blend together.
It'd be interesting to revisit the one. I can't remember if like he was going to try to destroy the world using the power of media. I don't know what his plot was. But I remember he was like some sort of media mogul.
I think it's this high-tech terrorism. Yeah, I think it's some kind of like captain of industry is trying to like control the nuclear subcodes or something, and he wants to like trigger nuclear war,
okay,
or something like that.
There's something we're still afraid of in 1999.
Apparently,
hmm.
Hey, Bond had to do something. I mean, you know what? He didn't have to do anything. They could have literally just made a two hours and eight minutes of him plowing Denise Richards. You know, it would have made just as much money. Everyone would have been happy
and just as much sense. Yeah. For fuck's sake, like, the first Daniel Craig Bond movie we got, it was Daniel Craig playing cards.
Yeah.
And we were finally, like, that was a great movie. We were like, oh my god, like, James Bond is cool again, finally.
Well, and again, that was also stripping down the craziness of it all. I think that they wanted to make a more down-to-earth, realistic approach.
Yeah.
Instead of, like, you know, every 15 minutes we have to destroy a $300,000 sports car.
Yeah, instead of, like, having, like, all of, like, the big explosions and stuff and nuclear war. Like, it began with just, like, a parkour running scene. Like, it wasn't even a car chase. It was just two dudes running after each other.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was good. The series was due for a... but, I mean, hey, Pierce Brosnan kept the seat warm, kept Bond relevant. As I recall before him, the series truly was dying.
I don't even remember. I don't know the order of Bonds. I don't even know who was before him.
I think before that, people were sort of like, there's a couple of good films, and everyone likes the Sean Connery ones, but there's a lot of trash.
Hmm.
And they also had so many different Bonds prior to him. I think that it's probably also good that they settled on a Bond and stuck with it for so long. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like what quarterbacks in Green Bay, you know, where it's like they had Brett Favre and now they've got Aaron Rodgers and they've been good for the past 30 years.
Goddamn, has it been that long? My goodness.
Something like that. You know, probably like 25 years or so.
So there was a movie, and I haven't seen this one, and I really had not heard about it either. It was called RKO 281.
Yeah, that's about the making of...
Citizen Kane.
Citizen Kane, yeah.
I can't find like any place to stream this movie either.
I wonder if it was an HBO film.
Hmm.
The guy, I think, I don't think it was made. I mean, maybe I shouldn't say. I don't remember that much about it. I remember enjoying it though. It was probably more entertaining than actually watching Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane is a well-made film. Don't get me wrong. It's one of those things that you can certainly appreciate.
Right.
But I would not necessarily say it's an entertaining movie.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that...
And Orson Welles has made some really fucking entertaining movies. Lady of Shanghai. Fucking incredible.
F for Fake,
yeah. That's a very mind game of a film.
Yeah.
You know.
But it is interesting that, you know, I think Citizen Kane, if I'm not mistaken, was his first film and kind of knocked it out of the park on his first try with just the different cinematic techniques that he would invent and go on to become mainstream. I think, like, between him and maybe Kubrick, no one's done more for actual, like, the technical aspect of filmmaking than those two. But, this thing totally flew under my radar. And, of course, like, I had not seen Citizen Kane in November of 1999. So, of course, I wouldn't have been paying attention to it. But I would like to check this out because it has to do with the sort of making of the film. Because Citizen Kane is kind of based on William Randolph Hearst.
Yeah.
The newspaper mogul, I think he started like the New York Times,
mm-hmm.
Or something that you might have heard of, and
the failing New York Times,
right? They've been failing for so long. When's then they gonna finally put the nail in that coffin?
Lion Ted.
So, I wonder how many lawsuits the New York Times has lost this week. Anyway,
yeah,
so neither here nor there. Which is the sort of like fight that or the sort of tension that existed between Orson Welles and William Randolph Hearst had when making this movie. That was kind of like, hey, we're gonna make a movie of your life and portray you as this sort of disaffected man who's desperate for any sort of acceptance or affection.
Yeah. And I think that's the whole punchline of it, Rosebud, was that it was just his sled, and it's sort of like, that's the thing that he remembered most.
Yeah, that's the last time you felt any sort of fulfillment.
Wow. What like, God, what a hollow existence.
Yep. For everything that he had.
Yeah. But again, yeah, I think if anyone's going to really get into film, it's kind of one of those movies you got to watch.
Yeah.
Just for the sake of saying you did. It'd be like, you know, saying you really liked the Bible, but skipping Exodus.
That's some pretty crucial stuff in there.
Yeah, things happen.
So, one more game to talk about before we round it out here. Donkey Kong 64. This one came out on November 22nd. It was developed by Rare and published by Nintendo. It stars the Donkey Kong, or the DK character, from the Donkey Kong Country series and is a follow-up to those games from the Super Nintendo.
I see here he is not a donkey.
I guess he is a Kong. Is Kong more of a title?
That's racist. but go on.
It is directed by George Andres, produced by Shigeru Miyamoto. Greg Malis was the lead designer. He's a pretty prominent guy from the early Rare days. composed by Grant Kirkhope, who did a lot of the Donkey Kong Country music, is a 3D follow-up to the very popular and successful Donkey Kong Country series that was on the Super Nintendo. And it was built on the engine for Banjo-Kazooie, so it had a lot of similar design sensibilities. For there's even more collecting than you do in Banjo-Kazooie. There's tons of stuff from coins and bananas and tablets and shit that you can collect. There are cumbersome mechanics for using different skills, like throwing oranges or firing a coconut gun. And just as a side note, the coconut gun was an interesting addition to the game. It was sort of conceived when they had a placeholder for the coconut gun, and it was like an actual like realistic shotgun. I don't think it was their intention to actually use the shotgun in the game, but it was just like, hey, we're gonna have him like shoot some sort of gun. And when they're like presenting it, Miyamoto was appalled by Donkey Kong carrying a gun. So he was like, no, we can't have that. And just like did a sketch of a coconut gun. I was like, do something like this. Yeah. So they did exactly that.
Wow.
It also features a needlessly opaque hub world, which I think just further goes to exemplify the elegance of the Mario 64 castle hub.
Yeah.
Banjo-Kazooie, DK64, both of these hub worlds are severely lacking in any sort of intelligent direction or sort of like nudging or leading you where you're supposed to go. I spent a lot of time just kind of wandering around the hubs in both of these worlds looking for some actual gameplay. And it's different in Mario 64. Mario 64 is like, it's broadcasted. Like, here's a door with a star on it. Fucking go there. Yeah. And also Mario 64, it's just more fun to engage with the mechanics of running and jumping and like and sliding around than it is in Banjo-Kazooie and DK64. DK64 in particular, there's a sort of like a slidiness or a floatiness to the way that he moves around, especially when you're engaging in melee combat. Because, you know, if you're stationary and hit your melee button, you like to throw some slaps around like a Kong would. And if you're running, you kind of do like this slide kick, and your momentum, it's like you're on ice. There's no sort of friction to the character. And also doesn't jump very high, so it's not particularly fun to jump around either. So you get put into this hub world and through some tutorials where the things you're doing aren't particularly engaging from a mechanical standpoint. One thing that I will say in the game's favor is like there are tons of collectibles. Unlike Mario 64, when you find one of your bananas, which are kind of the power stars of the game, you don't get kicked out of the level, so you can just keep on searching for more stuff. So it doesn't have like the sort of like morphing stages like you do in Mario 64, where, you know, the stage will change around depending on what star you're going after.
Mm-hmm.
The original idea for the game was as a linear platformer back in 96 when the game was first sort of on the boilerplate. About halfway into its 3-year life cycle, it switched over to a 3D platformer. It uses the RAM expansion on the N64, like Resident Evil 2, for better performance, such as frame rate and draw distance. There are 5 playable Kongs, each with different skills and unique collectibles that are totally unattainable by other Kongs, which leads you to having to exit and re-enter levels as different characters. Ooh. In order to get the stuff that you want.
Sounds tedious.
That is one of the major criticisms of the game. Yes, I have not gotten far enough to where that tedium has really set in, but there are so many collectibles. I was reading the...
Any new Kongs, by the way?
Yes.
I assume it's going to be Donkey and Diddy.
I think Dixie is in there, and there are... Cranky? No, not Cranky. There are a couple of new Kongs. Their names are escaping me right now, though.
Oh, okay.
God, all of their skills are they like DK has the coconut gun and like Diddy has a different skill, and that's also escaping me. I don't know why I brought it up, but there are Kong barrels where you kind of can swap between the Kongs, and so there's quite often pretty infrequent, which leads you to having to exit and re-enter levels. I am playing this on the Wii Virtual Console, so I can't speak to how well it works on the N64 controller. Rare likes to do this thing so far with their N64 platformers, which is to this point that we're talking, it's Banjo-Kazooie and DK64. They like to do this thing where the left shoulder button is sort of like a toggle, like you hold it down and it makes your C buttons on the controller do something different. And it's a frustrating thing because it's not a very elegant use of the controller.
I think it's already got a lot of buttons. Does it need all that?
Right. Because without any sort of toggle, those C buttons are doing your manipulating your camera, which, to the game's credit, does a pretty good job of tracking you without having to manipulate it too much. Yeah. There are a couple of different camera modes, and one is one that kind of tries to track you from behind, which works pretty well for a game from this era. But you have to toggle the left shoulder button in order to make the C buttons do something different, which will equip your different things, your coconut gun or your oranges, your projectiles. I don't know why you need two different projectiles, but you have them. And then there's a further toggle for the coconut gun where you equip it, and then you press, I can't remember what the button is, but you press another button, you go into a first person mode where you don't move around.
Do they
around.
Hollow point bananas that do extra damage?
That might be a further unlockable. There's tons of them in this game. This game is so bloated. But you enter the first person mode, you can't move around, but you get this free aiming target reticle. And yeah. There are certain, especially early on, a lot of panels on the wall. You got to shoot this with a coconut to open up this gate. And that sort of thing, just make it to where you have to jump on a switch. Why do you need an extra mechanic in here to do this sort of thing? And it's that sort of unrefined bloat that there were simpler solutions to what you're trying to do here. Instead of having to shoot the panel, make it to where you have to jump on the panel. You already have a jump mechanic. It's super easy. You're accomplishing the same thing. But that's just my general issue with the N64 platforming games made by Rare. There's a ton of content, but none of it's particularly refined. And it's never as fun to engage with the game mechanically as it is in something like a Mario 64. And at this point, we're 3+ years into the system life cycle. We're, crossing second base here. We're getting, we're in scoring position of the end.
Yeah.
And they're still trying to cram as much stuff in there to kind of see what works and what's fun. At this point, the example was there on launch day. This is what works. Nintendo already cracked the code. Yeah. Just do what they're doing and maybe add your own twist here and there, but there seem like they're just still throwing every idea against the wall. And to the game's credit, I think that climbing and swinging on vines in 3D actually works pretty well. I think they pulled that off pretty well, where you have the jump button, of course, and the button to cling on to things. So you just have to make contact with another vine, you're able to grab onto it with no problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something really could have tripped them up trying to do that in 3D, but I think they pulled it off really well. I think it looks and sounds pretty good in the context of its contemporaries. It's an all right looking game. You can get it for $30 on Amazon-ish, or okay. $10 on the Wii Virtual Console.
Seems like that's the standard going rate for a game that's not insert sport 99.
Right. Yeah, I think that's generally the case, because most every game we've talked about today, hey, $30 for this game.
Yeah.
And some of them
sold a bunch of copies, though. It said, I think, 2.3 million units pushed by 2004.
Yeah, and at the time, reviewed really well. I think over time, though, there was this sort of regression to the mean, where most people it got really praised at the beginning, and then after a while, I was like, no, that game has too many collectibles, so that's too much bloat. And now it's kind of reverting back to, hey, yeah, it was fine. It was an okay game. It was a pretty good game. I was reading the Wikipedia article, and of all the collectibles in the game, just all the different types sort of massed together, you need 280 in order to get to the credits and finish the game. But there is an excess of 3,000 collectibles total within the game.
What the fuck?
Yeah. Crazy. Good Absolutely Lord. Insane.
3,000 collectibles.
Yeah. there was an antidote. An anecdote. That's what I'm looking for. I was reading an antidote.
Yeah.
And I think that the game director was talking with one of the, I think it was one of the stampers, one of the founders of Rare, and sort of like going through like the game design concepts. And multiple times he said there were, like, he would have meetings and the guy, one of the founders of Rare, was just like, no, more stuff, put more stuff in it, more collectibles, do more. And no, that was bad advice. Should have done less.
Maybe 2,000 collectibles.
Yeah. No, a mere 2,000.
Yeah. Well, I see here that it wasn't the very first year of it, but the Game Critic Awards came out, and it looks like they are still ongoing.
Oh, yeah?
It won that year in a discontinued category called Best Platformer, which is a category that was exact in their list for just that one year.
Oh, okay.
So there was never another year of Best Platformer.
So that makes this the best platformer ever made.
Exactly, precisely. It's fun going through here, seeing what awards things won. Team Fortress got a bunch of awards, which I don't know if you ever played that one. That was
no, fun. I never played that.
Yeah, interesting stuff.
So, I think overall, I'm trying to reserve too much judgment until I play a little bit more of it, because you know I do have the ability to use save states to alleviate anything sort of super frustrating, kind of give myself a little cheat. Also, I've only played on the Wii U gamepad. I want to try it on the TV to see if a larger perspective kind of helps, because a lot of the areas, sort of like the to keep the Mario 64 comparison going, a lot of the worlds, a lot of the paintings that you go into are a much larger scope. Like just more space than in a Mario, which I think goes to, you know, show that Mario 64 had a much better focus. Like they knew, like they're not afraid of doing like a shorter level, which is something I think that to most Mario games credits, like Super Mario Brothers 3, a lot of those levels are real short. Yeah. Super Mario World, most of the levels aren't particularly long. Like they're okay with doing something like really brief. And like here's the best parts of this without any of the filler.
Yeah.
And I think I had one more thing in my notes here. No, I already covered that. Never mind.
I see our characters are Tiny Kong.
Oh, okay. He's from 3.
Lanky Kong and Chunky Kong.
Lanky. I think Lanky and Chunky might be new.
Yeah, it says here that Lanky's first appearance was in N64. Chunky Kong, playable character from N64 as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Older brother of Kitty Kong.
And this is the origination of the DK rap.
Yes.
It says at the beginning here, title screen.
Yeah, worst song ever. Worst video game song ever.
Is that an award of the game critics?
No, I think it may be like a video game Razzie award. No, I think it's it was just said that. It was DK rap is often cited as among the worst songs to appear in a video game.
I read another interview not too long ago where one of the, it might have been the composer, might have been Grant Kirkhope. I'm not sure.
Was
that
LL Cool J?
That'd be amazing if it was LL Cool J. But, God, that and Deep Blue Sea in the same year. God, what a 1-2 punch.
Yeah, for real. On fire.
This person who was talking about to the song was trying to like pass off, like, yeah, it was supposed to be tongue-in-cheek. It was supposed to be silly. Like, sure it was. Yeah. Of course. You say that now. But at the time, they're probably in the recording studio. Like, yeah, we're hip. This is going to be amazing.
Jeez. Hey, do you think that the Pokemon movie had the poker rap in it at any point?
I would hope so.
I feel like it's a closing credits. Even if it's not like the lead song in the closing credits, I feel like they give it to you around the time they start hitting like, you know, all the different...
Yeah,
you
when know. You get to like all the technical stuff, like here's the lead electrician and the gaffer.
Yeah, all that shit.
I mean, I think they would have to, at least the like the original 150.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they continued the poker rap after that. The original 150.
Mm-hmm.
Get your Rafa rig in there. Stand by.
Yeah, you just hearing you say that, it makes me hope they didn't.
Sunkern.
No, thank you. I don't need that shit.
God, could you imagine trying to rap Yanma?
Oh, God.
All right.
What we should do is, pretend they are, and then make Wes do it.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do. Yep. So, all right. Two more movies, and then we'll put the closer on this one. Toy Story 2. It was November 24th.
I saw that on the list, and I don't remember much about it.
Toy Story 2 was the one where they had to rescue... Woody was a bot at a garage sale by mistake. And sort of like a...
Did it turn out that he was abducted. Like super rare or something? That he was like very valuable and sought after?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And a collector tried to buy him and then just ended up abducting him. And he ended up sort of discovering his origins as this kind of campy children's show. And all of the like sort of memorabilia became highly collectible. So this guy, voiced by Newman from Seinfeld, God damn it. He was also in Third Rock from the Sun.
Wayne Knight.
Yeah. Ended up acquiring all this stuff and going to sell them
off to collectors. Along with Joan Cusack and Kelsey Grammer.
Yeah, Kelsey
Grammer. Also joining the cast.
Kelsey Grammer was sort of an antagonist in the film. And one of the things about the movie is that I feel like, you know, I've only seen like Toy Story 2 a couple of times and Toy Story 3 and 4, I think, one time each.
Yeah.
And something that I've noticed from my limited viewings is they don't seem to know what to do with the Buzz Lightyear character after the first film. So in the second one, they basically did the same thing again, where like enlightened Buzz gets taken off the table by some sort of circumstance, and then a different Buzz Lightyear takes his place, and the group is sort of unaware that there's been a switch. So he thinks he still is like he still has that identity crisis.
Yeah,
where he doesn't realize that he's not like an actual astronaut.
Yeah. So what we're gonna say is like, of all of the cast members, or not the cast members, but of all of like the characters in this, like he Buzz Lightyear is the one that's gonna come forward and be like, you know, Trump is trying to bring down the cabal of Jewish pedophiles.
Yeah, he's certainly the one who's like easily deceivable. Yeah. Without question. And then in what was it, Toy Story 3, like his language settings get messed with.
Oh, he got in Spanish mode or something?
Yeah.
That one I think I recall because it was literally like they were on a conveyor belt about to be immolated.
Incinerator, yeah.
Yeah, like incinerated, yeah. Thank you. And I was like, wow, this is really profoundly grappling with death for children.
Sure is.
In obsolescence. Uh-huh. And that, you know, the day we born, we get that much closer to death. It's like, this is harsh.
Yeah.
This is really harsh content.
Yeah. I think the fourth one also deals with that as well. It's like, once, it doesn't really deal as much with mortality, but like purpose as well. Like once you've kind of fulfilled what you've seen as your primary purpose, what do you do next?
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, they outside of issues with that they have managing the Buzz Lightyear character, they do deal with some pretty heavy themes in these movies about toys.
Yeah. That's John Lasseter for you. He just wants to really put the most horrible images in kids' heads, apparently.
So speaking of movies that try to deal with heavy themes, this one falls flat on its face. End of Days.
Oh, yeah, the Schwarzenegger film.
Yup.
This is the period where Schwarzenegger just kind of made unsuccessful bad movies.
Mm.
I mean, not bad movies. I wouldn't say it was bad. Like, he made one called Eraser.
Sure.
Which I remember having some cool action set pieces, but was ultimately, like, a super hollow film.
I think that's a good way to describe this one as well, is that, you know, they try to sort of mask the hollowness of it with these, you know, strong religious images. There are points in the movie where Schwarzenegger is literally like in the crucifix position. Yeah. And it of course earns none of that. He's just kind of like this low life throughout the movie. And he's kind of like this disgusting character. Like in a very literal sense, because like one of the first things you see him do is he takes like a coffee and a bottle of Pepto and like leftover Chinese and pizza and like all put it all in a blender. Like make like it is just fucking vile. Yeah. And then drink it. Yeah, it is really, really gross.
It reminds me of, I think it's in an episode of South Park where Randy is like gonna I think is it the dad fighting one?
I think it's the dad fighting one.
Right, where he's like, you see him do that, and he's like trying to imitate the Rocky scene where he's gonna eat their, like drink their raw eggs or whatever, and then he just like pours them into the pan.
Yep, and it like mixes them around. Like, no, I'm actually gonna cook this shit. I'm not insane. Yeah, that was a really great scene, like a subversion of expectations there.
Yeah.
But
I like this cast of Gabriel Byrne, Kevin Pollak.
Yeah, two Usual Suspect alums.
Yeah, both were Usual Suspects. Interesting.
Yeah, but you know, the movie, like, the plot was paper thin. It's this this woman who's supposed to, I suppose, mother the Antichrist. So kind of like has like a Terminator twist to it, where, you know, they need to protect the mom so she doesn't, this time, as opposed to Terminator, she doesn't give birth to what's going to bring her around the end of the world. And the antagonist of the film, whose name you just said is now escaping me, is just
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
is just
Randy Marsh
stalking her throughout the entire movie in an attempt to either father a child by you know, as with her as a willing participant or otherwise.
Yeah.
So there are some ridiculous action set pieces as well. One of the first ones is Arnold Schwarzenegger is bodyguarding the character who like becomes possessed by Satan or becomes Satan, and he is about to be assassinated by, turns out to be like a priest who's trying to thwart the whole plot, and Arnold Schwarzenegger like needs to get up to the position where the sniper was to, so he can bring that guy to justice, even though he's not a law enforcement officer, he's a bodyguard. And they call the chopper in to get him to the top of the roof.
Yeah.
And
classic stuff. Schwarzenegger needs his choppers.
Right, which is, of course, something that takes, you know, a really brief amount of time. You can definitely get a chopper to a location to get you up to a roof before the guy who's almost at the roof can get to the roof himself. Anyway, so they can't land on the roof. They take the chopper up so they can get to the roof, and the chopper pilot's like, "It's me, Brad Vickers, but I can't land on the roof because there's too much stuff on the roof. Like, why did you even take the chopper in the first place? Like, of course you can't land on a roof."
Wow.
And so what's Arnie do? Of course, he like buckles himself in with this carabiner and this harness and slides on down and like suspends himself in the air, and they just start chasing the guy, the shooter priest, across a rooftop as he is suspended from the chopper, and he's like making this face like he's pushing himself forward. Oh, like, wow. And they eventually like grab the priest as he's about to jump and kill himself in order to avoid being apprehended, and it's just so fucking ridiculous. It is so absurd, some of the action set pieces in this movie.
Yeah.
It's not very good. It's not a very good movie.
Yeah, this is kind of one of those How the Mighty Have Fallen, you know? Mm. This is a bad time. I think maybe in a few years we should probably talk about what happened with Robert De Niro's career from about the year 2000 to about the year 2006.
I'm down for that.
I think now Robert De Niro is thankfully in a much better place, where he has continued to be regarded as one of America's finest actors. Mm. There was this time where you would think he was deliberately trying to destroy his career.
Are we talking about like Meet the Parents?
No, that's kind of one of the better,
okay,
one of the better things that he was involved in. I mean, I could kind of give you a little tease here if you want to,
yes,
see what's going on.
I want to know.
All right. Oh, and by the way, Robin Tooney is the woman in
yes,
End of Days. She was the main girl in The Craft.
Mm-hmm.
So interesting. By the way, fitting also that we have two movies that are kind of both about the Christian faith. One is a comedy that actually manages to have a coherent point about Christianity.
Uh-huh.
That is also at the same time kind of making fun of it. And then the other one is like trying to do this kind of faithful interpretation of, or not faithful, but like just trying to make a serious thing about religion and then making it even sillier.
Mm. One of my favorite sort of monologues in Dogma, going back to that movie, is when Chris Rock is talking about Jesus and how Jesus is a black man, and it kind of goes on this monologue where he talks about like people being so afraid of the possibility of Jesus being black, like a black man can steal your stereo but not die for your sins.
Yeah.
And he touches on a lot of points about Christianity and faith and fear and racism. And it brings up a lot of, I think, intellectually like intriguing ideas. Things that are thought-provoking.
Yeah.
And then, you know, tells the dick and fart jokes.
Sounds about
so
right.
So you get the best of both worlds.
Yeah. again, you can't really. There's such a dichotomy to everything that Kevin Smith seems to do, where it's like it is schlocky and silly, but it's attempting to be better than it is, or it's. He seems clearly capable of making a good movie too. I don't know. Oh, I have the list here in front of me. Some things like Flawless, The Adventures of Rocky and Bullwinkle, 15 Minutes. He was in The Score, Showtime. Made a sequel to Analyze This, which did very poorly.
Yeah, Analyze That.
Godsend, Shark Tale.
My goodness.
Yeah, this was not... God, this was not a good time for him. And thankfully, I think he did meet the Fockers, so I think he's trying to get back to that, right? You know, only to do Hide and Seek the same year.
Oh, I remember. Oh, my God.
This is rough. This is a very, very bad time in his life.
Yeah, that was like, I don't know if it was like Stephen King property, but that was like someone trying to do their best imitation of like some sort of Stephen King type of horror story, and it went very poorly.
Yeah. Oof. Little Fockers as well, man. That came down the line. But yeah, there was just a, you know, again, great director that just like, you know, goes from literally Copland, Jackie Brown, Wag the Dog, to garbage.
Yeah.
Just garbage.
Wag the Dog also had Dustin Hoffman, didn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, you had Dustin Hoffman, and then you had them reunite and meet the Fockers. Yeah. Like, yeah, a legendary actor, or you know, Raging Bull, like everything he did with Scorsese, you know?
Yep.
Fucking Goodfellas and Taxi Driver, King of Comedy.
Yeah, it's tough to find a bad movie here. You know, Cape Fear, Night in the City, Boy's Life, Bronx Tale, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, I don't remember that.
I don't remember that either.
Casino, Heat, you know, The Fan. I remember The Fan, that was a weird movie. But yeah,
Yeah. So, you know, we should quickly address the rankings. I don't think I'm ready to rank Donkey Kong 64 yet, but we can at least put Resident Evil 2 on the list. Just as a point of reference here, let's go from...
let's do the top 15.
Top 15 N64 games as we've ranked them so far.
Yeah.
Ocarina of Time, Super Mario 64, Star Fox 64, Super Smash Bros., Banjo-Kazooie, GoldenEye, Pokemon Snap, Doom 64, Blast Corps, Mario 64, Mario Golf, Star Wars Rogue Squadron, Diddy Kong Racing, Hexen, and Quake 2.
Okay, let me see that list again. I have a feeling, I think it's better than Pokemon Snap.
I think so too. I kind of want to put this very high.
Are you thinking in between the 4 and the 5 slot?
I'm actually thinking in the 3 slot. Yeah.
Ooh.
I like this more than Star Fox 64.
Damn. Like I feel like Star Fox 64 gets a couple of points there for it being like, you know. It's own thing, kind okay. of like its own little Nintendo. Because this is a third party game and it is Capcom.
Uh huh.
And Capcom is the ruiner of dreams. but again, I love this game so hard. Yeah, I'm totally on board putting it in the 3 slot.
Cool. There it is.
Yeah.
Number 3 N64 game. Right behind Mario 64 and Ocarina of Time, Resident Evil 2.
If Wes were here, he'd be like, what? Why are we doing it this way? What the fuck?
I mean, yeah, maybe. But I don't think you can make a coherent argument as to why.
Yeah, that's true.
And you know, they do...
He'll judge our lists without creating one of his own.
Right. So, yeah, and you know, I do think, like, there are certain elements of the design that are, you know, at least comparable between Star Fox and Resident Evil 2. They're both sort of made to do these multiple runs.
Anthropomorphic foxes.
Yeah, yep, indeed.
All right.
Claire Redfield.
Raccoon City.
Yeah, well Claire done. Redfield. Yeah, well played. Yeah. Well played. But, the sort of like way that you're not playing this game in order to sort of fully absorb yourself into the God, now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm not sure where I'm going with this. In Star Fox 64, you're not like absorbing yourself into a narrative. In Resident Evil 2, the narrative is completely ignorable. And, you know, you have to sort of piece it together rather than just kind of like let it wash over you. In that way. So, you know, it's not a game where the narrative is the primary focus. And, you know, whereas Star Fox 64 could, like, because they're like a score attack game. In both games, you're just trying to find the most efficient way to get through it, and you get experimental with the sort of route you take or the weapons that you're using. Anyway, I don't think they're entirely dissimilar, but Resident Evil 2 is objectively better, as we've just decided now.
I think so.
So up next is going to be the official show. And I think the big highlight is going to be Hyrule Warriors.
Sounds good.
Which just came out yesterday at time of recording here. And I'm looking forward to it.
Very good.
Yeah, because I've clocked a bunch of hours already. And Leah, looking forward to get deeper into it.
I feel like most of the content I have for future podcasts is pretty much entirely centered around Pokemans.
Cool.
So I'll have some stuff in a few weeks when we get to that.
But yeah.
I don't know. We'll see what's going on. Maybe some gospel and gossip.
Hopefully. I'm going to have to look through the rumor mill to see if there's anything like where we've really entered. I feel like we say this a lot. We've entered a slow news period. It seems like we're always in a slow news period. Like, we're just waiting for the Nintendo Direct dumps.
I mean, we're a month away from Christmas at this point. So, yeah. Like, if it was going to happen, you'd think that we're really not going to be truly surprised by anything.
Hmm.
So,
yep.
I don't know.
Well, that's it. Yep. That's the end. Till next time.
All right, peace out.
So long. So long.